Welcome to River Hive Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and progressive action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. Dubbed one of the most inspiring films of the year, Hollywood's latest rendition of prison life is the story of Reuben Carter, the 1960s boxing sensation who served almost 20 years in New Jersey state prisons for a triple murder he never committed. The film, called The Hurricane, has attracted widespread critical acclaim and raised questions in the minds of many Americans as to the true nature of our justice system. But to those more acquainted with the realities of America's courts, Hurricane Carter's story is far from unusual. Since 1976, 82 death sentences have been overturned or commuted, and several states are currently considering measures that would halt executions pending further investigation into charges of police corruption, racial bias, and inadequate public defense. Beneath all the hype is the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a journalist and member of the Black Panther Party who was convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer in 1981. Like Reuben Carter, Abu-Jamal's trial was fraught with injustice, including harassment and coercion of witnesses and concealment of evidence. Sadly, he remains on Pennsylvania's death row, despite widespread international effort demanding a new trial. In this edition of Bruderhof Radio, we'll hear from Abu-Jamal himself as he describes the plight of those trapped inside the justice system. Recently, Abu-Jamal has written about racial biases in the Pennsylvania court system, comparing the treatment of suspected mafia members with that of black revolutionary activists. The following two segments, recorded in January 2000, paint a stark picture of judicial prejudice.
We are all taught that all are equal in the eyes of the law, and for many people, that is their belief. What shatters that belief, however, is the reality of what actually happens in the courts of the land. Not what the courts say, but what they do. Let us examine two cases, the so-called mob in black and white. In 1992, the Pennsylvania Superior Court, in the case Commonwealth versus Scarfo et al., reversed the murder, conspiracy, and weapons charges of eight men who were alleged to be members of the mafia and granted new trials. The state's intermediate appellate court cited a number of reasons for that reversal, among them that the prosecution elicited testimony that the eight men were made mafia members. I quote from the opinion. The Commonwealth chose to focus on the activities of the mafia and not the activities of the conspiracy. The prosecution elected to employ a strategy whereby it could elicit defendants' prior criminal activities through the back door. The Commonwealth's nomenclature, made membership, totally circumvents the purpose of the rule against admission of evidence regarding prior crimes, end quote. The court also found that the eight men were prejudiced by the prosecutor's references to them in closing argument as wolves, a wolf pack, and similar animal imagery. Such terms serve to dehumanize the accused, said the court, and the Scarfo court wrote, justice in this case requires reversal for a new trial because the defendants were not treated with fundamental fairness. In 1995, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided Commonwealth versus Jones, a case involving a man said to be head of the JBM, or Junior Black Mafia. Throughout the trial, witnesses and prosecutors made repeated references to the JBM and attributed to them a number of separate offenses, including murder. On appeal, when Jones tried to argue that errors in his trial were similar to those made in Scarfo, the court thought otherwise. There, the court ruled, such repeated references to JBM weren't prejudicial, but factual, and testimony to other crimes were merely harmless. Two trials, two results. Two appeals, two results. Two different standards of what prejudice means. Two mobs, one white, another black. Two different kinds of justice. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Many are unfamiliar with the reality of death row, for the Corporationist Press paints a picture of the row as an abode of the worst of the worst, while a truer picture is of those who are poorest of the poor, or even the weakest of the weak. Philadelphia alone, dozens of people have been slain in the streets as local mafia wars raged for over a decade. Which leads to another question. How many mafia hitmen were in Pennsylvania's death row? The answer, zero. Not one. How can this be, you ask? And the answer is simple. Real mafia guys are able to afford the best lawyers that money can buy, while the poor schmuck is stuck with court-appointed lawyers, hardly the craft's best. So, guess who goes to death row? Death row, it seems, is the prerogative of the poor. And what about mafia hitmen? Truth be told, there was one once, and the DA's office in Philadelphia fought harder than most defense lawyers to get him off the row. Sure enough, quietly, they did so. In fact, he never lived under the deprivations that are familiar to all people on death row. Why? Because he testified against his alleged bosses. What emerges is the politics of death, that the well-to-do and well-connected can afford to escape, and where one's poverty is a definitive aggravating circumstance. I've written previously of the Fred Thomas case, of the diabetic grandfather whose witness in his defense was run out of court by cops later convicted in the infamous 39th District corruption scandal, of young Jimmy Dennis, whose alibi defense was tossed aside by the courts, innocent men whose real offense was not being able to afford adequate defense counsel. And I assure you, they are not alone. Death row is not just a poor place, but a predominantly black place, with most from Philadelphia. Again, we see the politics of death.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
Of prosecutors and judges who seek political advancement on the basis of their fierce allegiance to the death penalty, except, it seems, when it comes to mafia hitmen. These same actors in the containment system have treated the Supreme Court's Batson case as little more than a joke. Batson allegedly outlaws using race as the basis for the removal of potential black jurors. But as a video training tape for the DA's office showed, the same game goes on by another name and with the same effect, predominantly white juries. Clearly, what the case claims and what the courts of the Commonwealth actually do are two very different things. And the result is predictable. Death. Clearly, unquestionably, this is time for a change. I thank you. On a move, long live John Africa. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Until recently, the change Abu-Jamal refers to seemed very far away indeed. Last year, 98 people were executed in the United States, the most in 1 year since reinstatement of the death penalty in 1976. In several states and at the federal level, steps have been taken to speed up the execution process and limit appeals for men with a date to die. Here, in a piece recorded on January 9th, Abu-Jamal addresses a group of German activists about yet another negative trend he sees in America, the execution of juveniles.
In the month of January 2000, several young men who were juveniles at the time of their offenses will be put to death by Texas and Florida. What kind of nation kills its own kids? America is that kind of nation. It matters not what any international convention or treaty may say. Those boys will be dead before the month changes into February. Why should any of this matter to you who live in other countries other than the U.S.? What has this to do with you? Well, as a recent battle in Seattle has shown, the forces that are straining to restrict, repress, and commodify human and other lives is a global one, one which moves in darkness and in secret. Now, if repression is global, why not, too, is it resistance? If the interest of capital to make global profits is an important one, why not the simple human right to life? As the ways of business dictate the broader rules under which all life is to be lived on this planet, why not the ways of resistance? Why is it not life that takes precedence over profit? People abroad are well placed to call the U.S. on the deep death culture that obtains here. Criticism from within the country, if at all, is muted. For America is a nation obsessed with legalism. Devoid of any national tradition of kings, all that is deemed legitimate comes from written law. Why do you think the U.S. took almost a half century to sign the anti-racism and anti-genocide conventions? In a move that guts the spirit while embracing the letter, Congress passes such accords with what they term reservations. That's conditions that transform such pacts into meaningless scraps of paper that no judge, no court, no institution need respect. As this is an election year in America, there's a rush to death, for nothing improves a politician's position as much as an execution, whether there was such a mobilization on behalf of life. Your actions, therefore, on behalf of life, become vitally important to reflect back the unflattering picture of the American culture of death, where over 3,500 men and women await death at the hands of the state, where among that number, some 80 youth, 17 years old and younger, await the gallows. From you may come that which does not yet exist in the U.S., an ethic of life.
Despite his candid analysis of the American death culture, Abu-Jamal is quick to acknowledge signs of hope. He sees the recent death penalty moratorium declared by Illinois Governor George Ryan as evidence of a shift in public opinion and hopes other states will follow suit. For this to happen, he says, many more stories of innocence and wrongful conviction must come to the surface. One such story is that of Abu-Jamal's fellow inmate, Fred Thomas.
Banished to the most exclusive club in America are deemed worthy of damnation, and in truth, all are presumed guilty, for did not a jury say so? Then one meets Fred Thomas, 53-year-old great-grandfather, who was projected to a jury as homeless, heartless, and in the words of the DA, quote, a predator, unquote. In a brief, week-long trial that went poorly defended, a jury convicted Fred of first-degree murder, and a day later, on February 28, 1995, sent Fred to death row in Pennsylvania. Now, why should one care about a homeless, heartless predator? Clearly, the jury didn't. What the jury never learned was that an eyewitness, located the day after the killing of a FedEx driver in the so-called Badlands of North Philly, gave a statement to the cops that she witnessed the shooting, named two of the assailants, and described the third, none of which remotely resembled Thomas. Indeed, her statement was corroborated by another witness who saw the three men running away. I know. The question arises, well, how did the prosecutor convict this man? Well, in their first attempt, they didn't, for the jury refused to convict and a hung jury was declared. In the second trial, the state provided two witnesses, both crack addicts, who claimed they saw Fred fleeing the scene, but even they couldn't go as far as saying they saw him shoot anyone, or even armed. According to the woman who did see the shooting, however, one of the assailants was related to one of the two witnesses who now placed Fred at the crime scene. These witnesses, both of whom had extensive criminal histories, were not asked about their drug-related activities despite repeated requests of counsel to do so. A homeless man, desperate for a dollar to survive, might rob and kill a truck driver, as would a drug addict. But Fred wasn't a homeless man nor an addict, but a hard-working man who worked a variety of jobs to support his growing family. He's innocent of murder, and as this was written, did have a date to die for November 23rd, 1999. He did receive, since this writing, a stay of execution. Now, in truth, this is his second death warrant, but the question arises, will he survive death row? A 53-year-old who recently was diagnosed as diabetic is now insulin dependent. He has one fervent hope. He says, I hope my health don't give out so I can live long enough to prove my innocence. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Mumia Abu-Jamal on Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program focusing on progressive thought and activism. We'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments about today's program. You can call us at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. In addition to wrongful conviction like that suffered by Fred Thomas, many inmates face a lengthy appeals process equally doomed to failure. Shaka Sankofa has lived on Texas death row since 1981. The National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty has highlighted his case for its injustice, saying, quote, compelling evidence exists which points to his innocence. Abu Jamal's recounting of this story reveals the horror of waiting for death not once, but many times.
On September 5, 1999, the man born as Gary Graham marked his 36th year in life and his 18th year in a Texas cage. Several years ago, the black death row prisoner changed his name to Shaka Sankofa after the great founder of the Zulu Empire of Southern Africa. For years, he's been fighting for his life, most recently against one of the most brutal killing states in America. Texas leads the nation in executions, spurred at least in part by the presidential aspirations of its governor, George W. Bush. Supporters from as diverse a grouping as the Pope, the Nation of Islam, and the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty have been critical of some aspects of his trial and called for either clemency or a new trial. Sankofa's trial was marred by conflicting witnesses, ballistics evidence that cleared his weapon from the killing, and even alibi testimony placing him miles away from the crime scene. Yet much of this wasn't brought out to the jury. Five times Sankofa has faced the gallows, and five times he has been granted last-minute stays of execution. What disturbs many observers is a provision of Texas law that disallows evidence of innocence that does not come within that state's narrow time frame. Supporters of Sankofa have released a CD featuring music and spoken word to support his new trial efforts called Let the Evidence Be Heard. In early September 1999, the papal nuncio, Archbishop Gabriel Montalvo, wrote to Texas Governor Bush, asking on behalf of Pope John Paul II that clemency be granted. But even the appeal of a pope may have to yield to an even higher power, the power of human political ambition. That was certainly the case as regards to the late Carla Faye Tucker, whose remarkable rehabilitation was treated like a joke. Shaka Sankofa has spent half of his life not only in a cage, but under threat of death, despite considerable evidence of his innocence. From his perspective, the U.S. is many things, but freedom-loving, it ain't. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For all its glaring inconsistencies, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is emblematic of a wider failure of justice in America. Like the now-famous Reuben Hurricane Carter, Abu Jamal has spent almost two decades serving time for a murder he may or may not have committed. But regardless of his innocence or guilt, it is Abu Jamal's rare ability to transcend prison walls that has earned him the status of international revolutionary icon. Through his writings, he joins the ranks of men like Hurricane Carter who see the world more clearly from their unique vantage point, the inside of a prison cell. In the following piece, Abu Jamal offers analysis of the recent battle in Seattle.
According to published reports, the planned meeting of the World Trade Organization was marred by violence, wreaked by thugs, anarchists, and hooligans. The danger of such mainstream media reports, however, is in the reliance upon police and government sources to prepare such material. In a mass action such as the Seattle anti-WTO marches, police are hardly neutral sources, for they are, in essence, combatants. Isn't it simply fair to present both sides? Jim DeSilas, a college student from Portland, reported via payphone to internet typists who set his observations around the world. His eyewitness account is, to say the least, enlightening. The following are excerpts, quote, "The government instigated a riot to discredit the movement against the WTO because they couldn't dilute it. I am not guessing about this. I was there. I saw it happening. And I will tell you, I am frankly shocked to see close up just how little our leaders care what happens to ordinary people. Clinton can pose and speak a lot of flowery stuff, but the truth is, we are nothing to them. I saw this with my own eyes," unquote. DeSalis' report,
"This call is coming from a correctional facility,"
recounts the aggressive nonviolence of the anti-WTO marchers and compares the single breaking of a McDonald's storefront window favorably to what occurs at a typical rock concert. police used that instance to launch their attacks against the people. I quote again. A small group, maybe 100 people total, struck back. Then these cops herded that group around the city, making sure there were plenty of photo ops of violent demonstrators. A number of times, they had these 100 or so protesters caught between buildings and walls of police. They could easily have arrested and detained a small group of people and gotten it over with. Instead, they would gas them and let them go. When you gas a person, let me tell you, it gets them fighting mad. Tuesday night, the police gassed all of downtown. This was going on from 3 p.m. till 6 p.m., gas everywhere. The kids broke a few windows, Mickey D's, Starbucks, small stuff, burned a few garbage cans. The police were using these people as extras. It was staged. I believe also the police had their own people in there, encouraging people to break stuff. If people think I may be exaggerating, I saw supposed protesters. They were screaming and so on. And then later, when everything was over, these same people tackled other protesters and put handcuffs on them, unquote. Well, I bet this report didn't get covered in the corporate media, huh? Meanwhile, protesters, even those who were aggressively nonviolent, were violently gassed, kicked, beat, and shot by peace officers. Is a rubber bullet a nonviolent bullet? Well, people in Northern Ireland certainly don't think so. For there, 14 people were killed, 7 children, by rubber bullets. In Seattle, DeSalas witnessed a cop shoot a man in the mouth, breaking out his front teeth. Do you remember a headline, a TV story, or a radio report calling these violent cops thugs or hooligans? I thought not. How then can the corporate media be trusted? And who is truly violent? One who attacks property or those who hurt people? Kids in Seattle break a half a dozen windows, and the media labels all protesters as violent. Cops beat, gas, shoot, and kick several hundred people. And the media reports they acted with restraint. Cops masquerade as protesters, and the media is silent.
You're listening to Bruderhof Radio and the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. More of Abu-Jamal's thoughts and writings are available in his two books, titled Live from Death Row and Death Blossoms. To end this edition of Bruderhof Radio, we'll hear a selection from 1996's Death Blossoms, recorded in September 1999. In this segment, titled Common Unity, Abu-Jamal offers encouragement to those who remain committed to permanent change.
The revolutionary John Africa, reading from Strategic Revolution, says, "Revolution is not a word, but an application. It is not war, but peace. It does not weaken, but strengthens. Revolution does not cause separation. It generates togetherness." John Africa. Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, once said, "Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Unquote. For millions, perhaps billions of us, life is a search, a journey of seeking for that which we found unfulfilled in our youth. We search for love. We search for family. We search for community. And in so doing, we seek the completion of self in others, in the larger self, where similar selves are united in
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
In community. As we search and grow, we find that modern life, with its bursting balloons of materialism, leaves us more and more empty inside. Things that once seemed to fill us now fail to bridge the gaping chasms in our psyche. Our inner selves are pulled in too many ways at once. The demands of work here and social obligations there, the pressures of financial need or the lesser burdens of wealth, public responsibilities, the needs and wants of our private sphere, and finally they break, atomized, meaningless. The dominant societal ideology of the hour is a perverse individuality hammered into our consciousness by myth and legend. It ignores the historical verity of community, of groups striving to move the social order forward. It ignores the reality that people working together are the only viable solution to any social problem. As human beings,
2 minutes remaining,
we are at root social creatures. Outside the bonds of our familial and social relations, we cannot truly live. Our very sanity depends on them. We are birthed in and into community. We grow in community. Community determines who we are. It is not the individual self per se, but its place in the broader social network of human society that defines our identity and gives our life meaning. Whether in religious, political, economic, or educational matters, collectivity is a basic requisite for meaning. Can there truly be a religion of one? What political action can be effectively undertaken by a lone person? Doesn't every step toward economic progress require at least some level of social agreement, some willingness to put aside antagonisms for it to function? Doesn't education, especially as it is presently constituted, consist largely of teaching youth how to play by the rules of the broader social order?
Remaining.
Is it purely coincidental that students are organized into classes? Doesn't it teach them how to acquiesce, not how, even whether, to transform the status quo? And what of a circumstance in which the status quo is unfair or oppressive? Such can be said to have given rise to a community of resistance known as the MOVE Organization, which, in the words of its legendary founder, John Africa, has as its reason for existence total liberation.
30 seconds remaining.
The MOVE Organization is a powerful family of revolutionaries, fixed in principle, strong in cohesion, steady as the foundation of a massive tree. A people totally equipped with a profound understanding of simple assertion, collective commitment, unbending direction. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal, reading From Death Blossoms.
That's all for this week's Bruderhof Radio. You've been listening to the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. To order Abu-Jamal's books, Live from Death Row and Death Blossoms, call Plow Publishing at 1-800-521-8011. Again, that's Plow Publishing at 800-521-8011. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 800-778-8461. To order tapes and transcripts, call that same number. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount. In particular, the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For further information about the Bruderhof Communities, call 1-800-778-8461.